Good morning. We have one large case on the calendar for oral argument this morning. United States v. Shyrock, Moreno, Hernandez, Aguirre, Arias, Therrien, Castro, Barrela, Gallardo, Mendez, and Hernandez. I understand that Juan Arias is submitted on the briefs and it's so ordered, and we'll then call this case for oral argument. I understand you have an explanation as to how it's going to be handled, counsel.
Yes, Your Honor. The appellants are going to take 10 minutes for rebuttal. I will present argument on two issues, the motion to suppress the evidence for electronic surveillance and the drug sentencing. Mr. Trevino will present argument on the motion to unseal, and Mr. Wallace will present argument on the RICO issues. We propose to divide our time, aside from the 10 minutes, for rebuttal 15, 10, and 10, and we'll do our best to get the time allowed.
All right. I'm not going to watch the clock that closely because it's important that everybody has a full and complete opportunity to make their positions, but use your time productively.
I will attempt to do so. Okay. May it please the Court, I'm Karen Landau. I represent Joe Hernandez, but as I said, I'm presenting arguments for the appellants. The district court, the government didn't provide complete statements of in support of necessity for the wiretap. And for that reason, this court has to review the denial of the motion to suppress de novo. The quantity of evidence that was held from the wiretap application is simply unparalleled. Those are the transcripts of the unredacted videotapes, which were summarized in a single paragraph, which did not include any of the crimes discussed, the participants, or the quantity of the evidence that was available to the government without a wiretap. The government also misleadingly minimized the number of consensually recorded conversations. There were 75. I believe the wiretap affidavit discussed 5 or 6. In all of these conversations, crimes were discussed, and personal participants' identities were mentioned. There was a plethora of evidence that was not disclosed in the affidavit. The other significant misleading misstatement was the description both of Castro as a target initially, but also the failure to admit that he was a leader of the Mexican Mafia. And by the fact that they had Castro cooperating with them, they had the ability to control those videotaped meetings. He had the ability to direct conversations to areas that the government was interested in. He had the ability to find out who other people were participating with. One of the things that the government...
How does that differ from the government's use of informants in any other kind of an investigation? I mean, judges know that most of the people who become informants for the government usually have been involved to some degree in the criminal activity that the government is investigating. So I'm not sure, I mean, as I understand your argument, Castro was a very high-ranking member who had turned.
He was.
How does that differ from the La Cosa Nostra investigations where they get the goods on
a
high-ranking member?
I'm sorry. That's okay. In fact, Castro was very high-ranking. He was also involved in many aspects, and he had personal relationships with almost all of the other defendants. In fact, I believe all of the other defendants. So he was able to find out more information than the average informant who maybe only has dealings with one participant.
So is your argument that basically the wiretapping was not necessary because Castro could do it all? Is that what you're suggesting?
That's correct, to some extent. I think there's two parts.
Well, how does that argument square with the fact that part of the investigation encompassed activities that were ongoing within the California prison system? And Castro, obviously, at that point, was not in prison.
He wasn't in prison, but he was the one who was pretty much in charge of Joe Hernandez, who was the conduit. He and Joe Hernandez and Antonio Rodriguez, he and Rodriguez, who is a deceased co-conspirator, were extorting Hernandez. And those were the people he was the closest with. So to say, well, we couldn't get the people in jail because, you know, he wasn't privy to every conversation. In fact, he was privy to that information, or he certainly could have gained access to it.
Let me see if I can take your argument to what I think is its logical conclusion. You're asking us to use this case to promulgate a rule which would require the district judge at the initial stages of a major organized crime investigation to predict where the investigation is going to go and how effective this particular informant will be in furthering the objectives of the investigation. And it seems to me from a policy standpoint that, number one, this is early stage of the investigation and it would be very difficult to do as a matter of fact. But secondly, I'm not sure that judges are very well equipped to make that kind of a determination because they don't have the ability to foresee the quirks and turns that the investigation is going to take. So I'm really asking you, how far do you want us to take this new rule that you're urging us to?
Your Honor, I'm not urging a new rule. I want to get back to the point that, first of all, what we're talking about here is a massive failure to disclose. So we're talking about applying an old rule. Now, the other thing is that the government cannot draw its objectives so broadly that a wiretap is necessary in every case. I think we would be in a different position if everything had been disclosed. You know, it might be more debatable, but here we have a misleading affidavit. And in fact, the other part of this is that this is not an informant. I mean, there's case law that when you have an inside informant, that is enough to defeat necessity. Here they not only had an inside informant.
What's your best case?
That's the Simpson case.
Simpson,
yes. I can't give you the side off the top of my head, but it's Simpson. Here we had an informant who was unusually well-placed. In fact, it wasn't just one informant, although I have been focusing on Castro. They had other informants. They had Philip Escobar. They had other people, some of whom, you know, Castro was clearly the most useful. I'm not going to try and argue that some of them were equally useful as Mr. Castro.
Well, this kind of raises, in my mind, a question of what the definition of necessity is. What's the definition of necessity?
The definition is that that traditional investigation methods have been tried and failed or would be too dangerous or reasonably futile. That's necessity.
I'm sure you're very familiar with the jury instructions that attach to informants. Notoriously reliable people. Jurors are told these people always have a motive to fabricate. You've got to deal with them in a different way than ordinary witnesses. They're just unreliable. They lie. They pull the wool over everybody's eyes. Usually the defense is yelling, "This is a liar. You can't believe anything the person says." I mean, I've heard that 1,000 times. I've written a lot of opinions in those cases. Informers, unless they're corroborated, are useless. Worse than worthless, because they can wreck an otherwise good case. So it seems to me that overlaying informants' information with a very valuable and reliable information, such as what you get from electronic surveillance, is necessary in the larger sense of the mission of the criminal justice system, which is to find the truth instead of just nonsense that's generated by informers. So how does that factor into this?
It would factor in, except that we had 75 consensually recorded conversations, most of which before the wiretap, that Castro recorded, most of which were not revealed, plus 6 videotapes, which are thousands of pages, between, I can't even tell you how long the meetings were, but those videotapes were overwhelming, and in fact they were the centerpiece of the government's evidence at trial. So they already had what you're talking about, which is more reliable evidence. They had it on tape.
On everything was corroborated. Absolutely everything that could possibly known about the involvement of the Mexican mafia and its activities was already known on tape?
Well, Your Honor, that's not the standard, though. I mean, one could always draw a wire. One can always say that set the objective so broad that you need a wiretap in every case. But, in fact, wiretaps have to be necessary. And I suppose, you know, well, as I said, one could draw There could be a wiretap in every case, or in every RICO case, or in every drug investigation, but that's standard.
Well, but maybe that happens to be the case. I mean, it's well known in the history of the investigation of organized crime that the New York Mafia, the Italian Mafia, as Rudy Giuliani likes to call them, was not brought down until they had everything on tape. John Gotti, for example, skated until they were able to corroborate people like Sammy the Bull Gravano with everything on tape, and it was only then that the criminal justice system functions. So it seems to me that having things down in terms of exactly who said what, when, where, and why is very important, not just to who wins or who loses, but to make sure that the system finds the truth.
But what you're proposing, Your Honor, then, is an amendment of Title III, because Title III does not provide for a wiretap whenever you need corroboration. It provides for a wiretap when it's necessary.
And that's why I asked you originally, what's the definition of necessary? And do you take a look at that in the larger sense of what the truth-seeking mission of the system is? I mean, one of the major problems with the criminal courts in areas of organized crime over the years has been informants lying and pulling stunts with evidence. And we've seen people who've been released from death penalty conviction basis of jailhouse informants, for example, who just make things up right and left. So it seems to be that it's valuable to have things on tape.
It can be. And again, in this case, they did have things on tape without the necessity of a wiretap.
Yeah, but everything on tape.
Well,
I mean, and looking forward prospectively, as the government must do and as a judge must do when a judge takes a look at this when these things are submitted.
Well,
I mean, I've spent 4 years doing nothing but reading every electronic surveillance application in the United States. When I was in the Justice Department, I read every one of those, and everyone dealing with an informant has its own peculiar problems. How much do you rely on them?
But to get back to this case, Your Honor, I have to go back to the appellate standard, which is that if the admitted evidence had been disclosed, after reverse, if the judge who reviewed the wiretap could have decided not to issue it, and when you look at it in that context, the sheer quantity as well as the quality of what was not stated in that affidavit supports a reversal.
This is kind of tricky. Who's the judge when you say the judge who issued it?
The judge who issued the wiretap.
Yeah, who was that?
That actually, in this case, was Judge Reel.
Judge Reel. And the case never went back to Judge Reel for a determination.
No, actually, you're right. The extension affidavits, well, you mean you're talking about the motions to be decided by the trial judge. That's right.
And the trial judge was not Judge Reel.
That's right. That's right. But it's not. It's an objective standard. It's not a subjective standard. It's whether a reasonable judge could have decided not to issue it. So it's not as though Judge Reel personally.
So we don't have to take. We don't. It's not whether a reasonable Judge Reel would issue it.
No, that's not the standard.
Okay.
If there are not further questions, I'll move on to the sentencing. Okay. The sentencing in this case. We'll start with the proposition that under the relevant conduct provisions of the guidelines, the sentencing judge has to make individualized determinations as to the scope of each defendant's agreement and what's reasonably foreseeable to that defendant. That did not occur in this case.
Well, what kind of a verdict form did we have? Did we have a special verdict form?
No, we did not. This was a pre-Apprendi case, Your Honor. It was tried, I believe, in 1996. So this was long before we were talking about drug quantity and special verdicts.
Okay, so the charts that I've seen, I guess it was at the close of the government's brief, were simply a reflection of the jury's acquittal of some of the defendants. Is that correct?
Well, I'm not sure which chart you're referring to.
There's a chart at the end of their 350-page
magnum opus. I believe there's a chart that links, that purports to link certain defendants to, that talks about certain gangs and where they're mentioned in certain exhibits, if that's the one you're thinking of. So, for example, there's a line where it says Breed Street Gang, and then there's another column where it says Exhibit 209. I'm not right on the exhibit number, but that's, yes.
Okay.
Is that what you're...
Well, I guess that there were various racketeering acts. I prepared my own chart as a result. Go ahead.
My mistake. I see what we're talking about here. Well, let me clarify. This argument pertains primarily to the defendants. Well, it pertains to the defendants who it pertains to the drug sentencing, and there are defendants who were convicted of Vicar murder. And my argument does not go to that. So if you have questions about, I would prefer to address those to. There are defendants who have challenged their Vicar murder sentence, but I'm not. Those are individual arguments that I would refer them to.
Okay, but why can't the district court, and this is a question, I don't care who answers it, I'll just pose it, dodge it if you will, and I don't mean that in a pejorative sense. You guys can decide who answers it. But my question is, why can't the district court, in terms of sentencing, consider the convictions on the racketeering act counts at the same time it is considering the convictions on the narcotics counts in fashioning an appropriate sentence under the guidelines for each of these defendants, since we have multiple counts of conviction?
Well, of course it can, Your Honor, and that would go to an Apprendi argument, but I'm not making an Apprendi argument.
We'll wait for Mr. Trevino.
Yeah, I'm not contending that. For example, my client received a sentence of 384 months. I cannot argue that there's an Apprendi violation because his sentence was in the total statutory maximum.
Okay.
But what's wrong with my client's sentence and with the other clients who were sentenced at? First of all, most of their sentences were, aside from the defendants perhaps who had mandatory life, but the defendants' drug sentences were driven by drug quantity. And so the first problem, and the main problem certainly for my client and some of the other appellants, is that the judge attributed to my client personally all of the drugs that were sold by a number of street gangs within an 18-month period, or perhaps a 12-month period. This is flawed for two primary reasons. First of all, it's not an individualized sentence because it didn't examine the scope of each defendant's agreement. Second of all, as we've argued in our briefs, the methodology is fundamentally flawed, and the expert testimony...
So you're excluding Pinkerton liability? Because, I mean, he sat through 8 months of testimony, didn't he, listening to how all the drugs got distributed?
Well, Your Honor, Pinkerton liability, that's part of the problem here. The guidelines do not provide for Pinkerton liability.
But the Supreme Court does.
The Supreme Court does, but that's a question of guilt. That's not a question of the sentence to be received here, because we're really talking about the guidelines here.
The argument is that guilt has nothing to do with the guidelines? This is a new...
No, of course it has to do with guidelines. I'm not talking about the standard of proof or... But what I'm saying is that for the purposes of the guidelines, and that's what we're talking about is the guideline sentences, where does the defendant's base offense level, where is that going to be set? That is determined based on the guideline principles. Now, you can have conspiratorial liability.
And the evidence adduced at an 8-month trial.
Well, right? Of course, it's based on that. But here, there was very little evidence of quantity. And, you know, the bulk of the government's proof went to... Sorry.
No, I'm sorry.
The bulk of the government's proof, a lot of it, certainly there was some drugs that were seized, but they were relatively small quantities. Most of the government's proofs obtained from the tapes, except that the tapes largely didn't discuss quantity. Often they didn't discuss the amount of money. So we don't have any calculation.
So this is sort of the classic problem that we have in historical conspiracy cases where people are talking about drugs that they're distributing, but we don't seize them. They're not weighing them at the time they're talking about them, and it's kind of anybody's guess as to how much.
It's even more truncated than a classical case because many of these defendants were not themselves distributing drugs. The street gangs were distributing drugs. Some of them may have been distributing drugs themselves, but some of them weren't. And every defendant was differently situated. Some defendants had relationships with some gangs. Some of the gangs sold drugs. It's not clear how often the gangs sold drugs. We don't know how much gangs sold. Some may have been more successful than others. But what we have is these bald-faced assertions. These gangs sold drugs, and we know they sold this much, basically, because they're street gangs, and therefore this should be attributed
to
all of these defendants.
Well, obviously this is not like counting pork bellies on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, but can't the district court rely on the testimony of the Los Angeles police officers who worked these gangs in essence extrapolating numbers and then taking a conservative estimate in order to come up with a reliable number for sentencing purposes?
Well, that's the second step. Again, the first step is to make a finding regarding the scope of each defendant's agreement, which wasn't done. Yes, extrapolations are permissible, but to make a valid extrapolation, you have to have a factually supported assumption from which to work. Here we have officers who most of them could not remember individual sales. They didn't even review their arrest reports before they prepared their declarations. So they most of them remember made purchases. Most of them bought $10 to $20 rocks, which is 0.1 to 0.4. From that, they estimated that, you know, the total quantity sold by the gang per day. I question whether that's a sufficient factual foundation. They couldn't remember who they could arrested. Essentially, you can boil down their estimates to say, yes, I'm making this expert estimate based on my experience and training. But that's really not enough. I mean, that's not enough. I mean, if you analogize this to the cases in this circuit regarding expert testimony at trial and what kind of law enforcement, the limits of law enforcement expert testimony, like Permanek, is a recent case, it just doesn't meet that standard. Now, I'm not saying they may be able to do it. You know, they may be able to go back and look at those arrest reports and, gee, I made... If somebody had come in and said, gee, during this week, I bought a total of 10 grams and $1 rock from this gang or from these three gangs, maybe we could make an... And then let's say they came back another week and several times, you know, during a three-month period, and they had a number of days. I will close in a moment. Let's say they had a number of days.
I'm not pushing you. Go ahead.
Okay. They had a number of days. You know, they need enough to have an adequate sample. That's the basis of expert testimony, is you need enough of a sample from which an extrapolation can be said to be valid. And this court has so held repeatedly.
Back up just for a second. You say there needs to be an individualized determination in order to even open the door on sentencing.
That's right. So,
and what guideline section do you point
to? That's the relevant conduct. When we talk about conspiratorial liability for drugs, yes.
Was the district court asked to do that in this case?
Well, he was in a sense because...
Here's where we start to get...
Okay, but no,
he was in a sense.
He was. He was the attribution of all of the quantities of drugs sold by the street gangs to each defendant was challenged by each defendant. So, yes, that amounts... That's the same thing. That's the same thing. It was challenged.
Okay. And what was the district court's response to the challenge?
The district court simply said, I'm paraphrasing, but the district judge said, well, it's a conservative estimate, so it's okay. He said essentially it's so easy to get to 1.5 kilograms of crack, and this was a long period, that's enough.
And the district judge was relying on what body of evidentiary information to say it's so easy?
I would assume, I can only say that he relied on what was in the PSIs, which we discussed, and the testimony of the three officers.
Was there any countervailing evidence offered, or was it simply to try to tear apart?
It was cross-examination.
Lengthy
cross-examination, which is in our excerpts.
Does this amount to findings of fact by the judge?
I would say it's not findings of fact. It's a conclusion of law. I mean, really, that's when we talk about the scope of an agreement, we are talking, especially given that there are no findings of fact. If the judge had said, I find, for example, with my client, that Joe Hernandez was responsible for this body of drugs, it would be a mixed finding, actually. But there aren't findings like that, so there are really no findings of fact.
Well, wait a second. I thought you said that at some point he said the amount of drugs the amount of crack that was distributed was so voluminous that I have no problem concluding that each defendant was responsible for at least 1.5.
Isn't that
a fact finding?
I don't think he actually said that, but he said that the evidence is low, and the street gangs distributed these drugs. And again, there's a difference between, as I said.
But I guess that where I'm going is to get to the base offense level for quantity.
Right.
At some point, and I guess it's what, 1.5 kilograms
that's
of crack?
Crack, yes.
That's as high as it goes.
It's as high as it goes.
So it's 1.5 or more. And if the district judge says, look, I listened to all this evidence, I heard the testimony of the officers, and there's enough here to conclude as to each defendant that he was responsible or it was foreseeable that at least 1.5 kilograms was distributed, isn't that enough under the guidelines?
It's problematic here because, again, he didn't make individualized findings. He made a global finding. He said, essentially, the way it was attributed is that essentially you belong to the Mexican mafia. You were all a part of this deal.
But now we're back to the Pinkerton theory, aren't we?
But again,
Doesn't Pinkerton allow him to do that?
Not the sentencing. No, not for the purposes of the sentencing guidelines.
Why wouldn't the foreseeability rule of Pinkerton apply to sentencing if it applies to guilt?
The foreseeability rule applies after the scope of the individually undertaken agreement is evaluated.
That doesn't answer my question. I don't understand the distinction between applying Pinkerton to sentencing and applying Pinkerton to guilt. It's the same analysis, isn't it?
It's a similar analysis, but Pinkerton allows the jury to find a defendant guilty of a substantive offense by virtue of being part of a conspiracy in which a co-conspirator did the substantive offense, and it's reasonably foreseeable.
Right, because the defendant at that point was a member of the conspiracy,
and again,
that is an act that is reasonably foreseeable and further.
That is the act once you get to the reasonably foreseeable analysis, but there's a two-step process, and the guy in the first step evaluating the scope of the defendant's individually undertaken agreement. Things can be foreseeable to a defendant, but not within the scope of the agreement.
But isn't the issue to be decided here the amount of drugs that the enterprise was foreseeably distributing?
No. The issue to be decided at sentencing is, the issue to be decided here is whether the district court did enough, but the issue to be decided at sentencing is whether is what each defendant agreed to. And for some of the defendants, that's very different. They joined the conspiracy at different times. They had different roles. They had different involvements. Excuse me. And so it's very different. There's one defendant who was only marginally, if at all, involved in Los Angeles at all. I've far exceeded my time, so.
Everybody wants to sit down fast.
I just don't want to cut my co-counsel short.
We're not that nasty. Are one of you going to talk about the issue of videotaping hotel rooms not rented by informants?
Mr. Lichtman is, I believe, prepared to address that issue.
Okay. All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms.
You're all experienced lawyers. You're not going to waste our time, so please don't feel pushed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I won't. May it please the Court, Philip Trevino. I'm appearing for Jesse Moreno and arguing on behalf of all appellants. And the particular issue that I would like to address this morning is the sealing of documents that were submitted before the district court. As a detour, if I may first, Judge Stallman, address the concern that Your Honor just raised with regard to sentencing. My client also is not situated in such a fashion that that kind of parallel calculation would matter to him. So I'm afraid I'm going to duck that question.
Okay. I think Ms. Landau did a good job of articulating. I understand the position.
But if I can, for a moment, ask the Court's patience to come back on the latter point about why Pinkerton liability wouldn't also provide for a framework for these questions about the narcotic approximations. And I think the answer is just one that involves the history of Pinkerton, and that is that it predates the guidelines entirely. And I think what the Court perhaps has in mind is what used to be the scenario under federal law where upon conviction, whether it be on Pinkerton theory or some alternative liability, the defendant and counsel went in before the court realizing that it was a range of zero to whatever the statutory maximum was for the offenses of conviction. And it was fully vested within the discretion of the sentencing court to determine what the sentence was. And the sentencing court had that discretion based on the evidence it had received during the trial or through other means. Today, the Sentencing Commission has been vested with, and the district courts in turn are now charged with the responsibility for adjusting, if you will, pursuant to those particularized calculations, the adjustments for the offense levels, to make that precise finding.
Is there a case that says Pinkerton methodology has no place in guideline sentencing?
Not that I'm aware of, but that certainly hasn't been where my focus has been in the last few days.
This may be the case.
It might have been filed under seal.
good answer.
And if I may, I'd like to turn my attention to that topic. And, Your Honor, Judge Trott, you, just in the context of the wiretap, talked about how it is really helpful to have everything on tape. And I can certainly appreciate that that's true for the machinery that is our justice system and certainly for the reviewing courts such as this one. And it would have been equally true to have everything available for review for the defendants in front of the district court and also in front of this court in preparing our appellate materials. There has been, as this court can certainly assess from our pleadings, a substantial amount of wrangling over the materials that were submitted under seal and ultimately under seal and in camera before the district court. And I respectfully submit to this court that none of it has resulted in any sort of resolution as to the appellant's satisfaction. And with all due deference and respect to this court, for that very reason, and wish to lodge an objection to this court taking this matter under submission at the close of this argument. And the simple reason for that is, as has been documented and preserved throughout our pleadings to this court, we still don't know that we have, and in fact we firmly believe we don't have, a complete record according to which we could assess all of our potential issues and present all of the claims or evidence in support of them to this court. It's an unusual step I've never taken before, to ask the court not to submit at the conclusion of argument.
We'll give you an opinion on it.
All right. But I do wish the court to understand that, yes, there are minutiae exuding from all of those voluminous pleadings, but the net result is still the same. We have never had a court, certainly not the district court, and we're hopeful it will come eventually from this court, but we haven't had a court yet tell us, this is the analysis that was conducted, the weighing of what the compelling interests are that allow the proponent, as the case law requires, that in this case overwhelming to the government, that allows the proponent to make this submission to the district court and yet not disclose it, either to the public and also not to the appellants. That, we've had a lot of other statements.
Well, what I'm hearing is that there are no circumstances under which anything can ever remain sealed from the defense. Is that what you're telling me?
No, I'm certainly not saying that, Your Honor. There are certainly circumstances under which things may properly be filed and may remain permanently.
What are those circumstances?
Let's assume, for example, that a particular witness who may be threatened. There are fact-specific details that for some reason, part before the court needs to go to the court and provide that information to the court. And they're helped on the part of the other litigant.
But isn't that the standard? The court shall take a look at the material the government says has to be sealed and make a determination. And if there's any reason,
well, that's if I may
then
partially
it's to be turned over, the government can dismiss its case.
Sometimes we get to that result where that submission is properly made and is properly withheld. But I'd like to suggest that there's a threshold question which is all too often overlooked, and it certainly appears to have been consistently overlooked here, and that is there a reason that the government even needs to provide this material to the court that is presiding over the matter that involves all the litigants? In other words, why is this matter coming in front of the court to begin with?
Well, let's take a hypothetical. Suppose we're talking about a threat to one of the witnesses. Is it your position that the court has no interest whatsoever in protecting the integrity of the and the physical being of the witnesses who testify before it?
No, it isn't. But I don't see that the two are necessarily directly connected. If the prosecution, let's say through the law enforcement team, learns of a threat to the physical safety of a particular witness, then it certainly that is law enforcement's function, is to address that. And
so,
to extent
so it is not a consideration for the due administration of justice if we have witnesses who are threatened or evidence that may be tampered with, and that information is brought to the attention of the court by the government. That's improper.
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying that's improper. I'm saying that without further information, without something to show that it's relevant for the presiding court, the presiding judge, to actually receive that information, the simple fact that a threat has been made doesn't necessarily implicate the security or safety of the judicial process.
So the court has no interest whatsoever in knowing that a witness who has been subpoenaed to testify before the court is being intimidated by threats of violence.
The court just added another link. If it's connected to a witness here in front of the court, now we've gotten one step closer to where we have an appropriate or possibly necessary instance where the government may make that kind of a disclosure to the presiding judge. My suggestion to the court is this is an analysis that has consistently been entirely truncated, which is that the government has arrogated unto itself the ability to determine it's appropriate to make these submissions, and nothing further needs to be said.
Well, if in fact the court seemed to have agreed with the government that this is, that there's no reason to reveal the submission to the defense.
And we're constrained to disagree. We disagreed below.
This is awfully abstract because you don't know what we're talking about.
I have no idea.
Isn't that always the case in situations like this under CEPA and everything else? 15 years ago, we had a terrorist case in Los Angeles, and I myself walked into court one day without the knowledge of our AUSAs and said, I've got to see the judge. Mm-hmm. And everybody objected except my AUSAs who worked for me. I went and saw the judge. This was after I had to make a trip to Washington, D.C. to meet with government officials. I laid a gigantic submission on the court. The court looked at it and said, you're right, you don't need to turn it over, and I understand why you've submitted it in camera. Boom, sealed, gone. It came up, and it's in a printed opinion, Sarkissian case. It says, we've looked at the sealed material. There's nothing the defense needs to know about. Goodbye. And the defense is probably still complaining that they don't know what that was all about. And you'll just have to trust me that there were reasons that caused me to submit that in a sealed fashion, and there were reasons that the judge said didn't have to be turned over, and there were reasons the Ninth Circuit agreed with everybody. So that's a kind of a situation. You get into these frequently.
I can agree with that, but 600-plus times in a particular matter, Your Honor, or 38 times in camera?
Numbers don't make anything to do with it if every one of them is justified. What I can tell you is that we will examine all that material and make sure that the rulings are appropriate. And if there's anything in there that should have been given to the defense, I would assume we would take appropriate action.
Well, Matt, suggest to the court that not only does the case law not find that a satisfactory answer, that...
What is the answer, then?
The answer, there be a fact made by a court stating what this, giving not the particulars, not the specific information, which obviously needs protection, but the nature, the generalized nature of the information that's being withheld.
Yeah, and that's the example that I had, and it could not be done.
And I'm,
that itself was classified triple top secret.
And
subject matter.
I'm confident that those scenarios do occur, and they may have occurred in this case. Our complaint comes principally from the fact that this vast number of times in which they're alleged to have occurred. And we know also, if for no other reason than by virtue of those limited materials the district court did eventually provide to us, that that wasn't the instance. That wasn't the type of controlling standard that was at work in this case. There were a number of materials that were disclosed where there really should never have been a sealing to begin with. We don't have indications that an affirmative decision has been reached that a lesser closure would not have been adequate. We stand before the court not even knowing what the materials were that the district court used, or partly at least considered, in denying the wiretap motion. We stand before the court not knowing what information it was that caused the United States Attorney to go to the district court with information about potential jury misconduct. These aren't instances where it's a witness, but, or at least to our knowledge, and we don't know. It's speculation. This is, after all, a case where a Los Angeles Police Department was in front of the courtroom taking the names of people who wanted to attend the trial. This isn't just any case, if you will, and it's not. And I understand the court's frustration and can appreciate that there are circumstances where it's legitimate, where it should happen. And it may well be that some of these under seal and under seal in camera submissions were appropriately made in that fashion. We have been left completely in the dark is our problem. And I do want to emphasize, we do appreciate the distinction between under seal and under seal and in camera. It's a distinction that unfortunately has been observed more often in the breach than anything else in these particularized documents. And we, and before this court, have tried to make clear that distinction. But certainly there's a lot of fluidity on that particular point.
Well, at the very least, you're asking us to take a look at all this material and make sure that you haven't been hit behind the ear with some information that should have been turned over to you.
We are. And in recognition of the enormous task that this court has before it, we emphasize we've been doing that for some time.
I think we have the boxes.
I'm pleased to know they're out of our domain. Unless the court has any questions, I'll defer to Mr. Walsh for him to begin with the legal arguments.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If it pleases the court, I'm Joseph Walsh, the attorney for David Gallardo, and I was going to focus my arguments on the RICO jury instructions that relate to the jurisdictional element, the effect on interstate commerce that has to be proven not only for the RICO charge but also for the Vicar counts, and also for the use of the firearm counts because they're predicated on valid.
You must have enjoyed McCoy.
I thought it was very instructive, and but I thought that the actual fact pattern in McCoy was a little bit different from our fact pattern. Our fact pattern, I think, almost mirrors United States versus Papadopoulos. That was the federal arson case by the Ninth Circuit. And in that particular case, it was arson of a single-family residence, and the jury was instructed that a building, including a private residence, is used in interstate commerce or in an activity affecting interstate commerce if it is supplied with natural gas that moves in interstate commerce. And so we think that we come precisely within the holding of that particular case because of the supplemental jury instruction that was given in this case, where the jury was told that an enterprise or its activities engaged if you find that an enterprise or its activities engage in interstate or international drug trafficking or the use of interstate communication devices or the possession of a weapon which traveled in interstate commerce, then you may find that the interstate commerce element is met. So I think that in terms of fact pattern, we're almost identical to that which was raised in the Papadopoulos case. And the issue of what was...
Let me ask you a question. Congress conducted very extensive hearings when it enacted the Organized Crime and Safe Streets Act of 1968 and created RICO. And it made certain factual findings with regard to the impact that organized crime activities have on commerce. Are we to completely ignore those legislative findings in assessing this issue in this case?
No, but I would say that in looking at those legislative findings, you have to look at what Congress ended up with. And it ended up with a statute that had a jurisdictional element requirement that required that in every RICO case, the government had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the activities of the enterprise had an effect on interstate commerce. And that jurisdictional element really separates the RICO prosecution from prosecutions like Wickard versus Filburn, where based on legislative or congressional findings, they said if you grow wheat beyond the limit, that's all we have to prove, and if it's homegrown wheat, you can be fined. And in that particular prosecution, there wasn't an element that required that his homegrown wheat had an effect on interstate commerce. But in a RICO prosecution, there is that element, and it requires that it be proven in every particular case.
But isn't your argument that our case law that has previously approved a minimal effect on interstate commerce should be upgraded to substantial? Is that what you're...
That's what I thought your main argument was.
We've argued that, but we tried to be reasonable in our argument because we have stated that the juvenile mail case was properly decided because under the facts of the juvenile mail case where they had a wholly criminal organization, they robbed an international business. It's the sandwich company has offices or businesses in every state. And the result of that robbery was an employee was killed, the business had to be closed for 3 days, they lost money. There was a substantial impact on that business. And so although the language of the court in the juvenile mail is that you don't need a de minimis effect on interstate commerce, there was a substantial effect in the Subway sandwich case. What we're saying is that RICO, when you're prosecuting a RICO case under Turquette, where we don't have a legitimate business like a labor union or a company, but you have a wholly illegitimate organization, like a group of individuals who are organized to commit crimes. That type of RICO comes in two forms. The one form is like juvenile mail, where they're attacking businesses and interfering with an international with interstate commerce because that's an interstate business. There, you would only need a de minimis impact on interstate commerce.
But so it turns on who the victims are?
It turns on the nature of the racketeering act or the nature of the activities. Now, if you take the best argument that we have...
Well, I guess let's go back to my question then about the 1968 legislative history, because Congress was looking at organized criminal behavior in prostitution, gambling, narcotics trafficking, loan sharking, all activities which are inherently illegal in nature, and yet found that that has an impact on commerce. So I don't see that there's any support for the decision you're trying to make.
The RICO, or the result of those legislative hearings was that organized crime infiltrated legitimate businesses and operated them through those types of criminal acts.
But Congress wasn't distinguishing between supplying mafia meat to the restaurants or taking over the unions that operated the trucking companies in the garment district in New York. They were looking at sort of the overall picture of the enterprise and all of its tentacles, some legal and some illegal. And I don't find the distinction that you're trying to draw there.
Well, they started out with the concept of organized crime infiltrating legitimate businesses, and it ruins the national economy.
But it also corrupts judges, and it corrupts the judicial system, and it threatens witnesses, and, I mean, a host of other impacts that are less direct but nonetheless harmful to commerce.
Yes, but that's where the Morrison, Lopez, and Jones cases come in and say and tell us that when the focus of Congress goes off the interstate commerce aspect or the commercial aspect and focuses directly on street crime, for example, in Lopez, it was the possession of a gun near a school. In the Morrison case, it was a rape on campus. And in the Jones case, it was the burning or arson of a private residence. The Commerce Clause steps in and says when the focus gets off of the national economy and interstate commerce and focuses solely on criminal acts. In this particular case, the racketeering acts were one Mexican Mafia person was accused of shooting another person, Mexican Mafia member, in East L.A. That person died on the streets. That had no effect on interstate commerce.
That's not what Congress said in 1968.
Mr. Walsh, if we can get to the... You were getting to the facts of this case, for which I compliment you in doing. Was some evidence that there were guns involved here which had moved in interstate commerce. And I think your argument then is, even though there was the evidence of the connection of the guns to the activity the government had to prove was insufficient.
Right. It was too tenuous under the Jones and Morrison case. Because you have to go back to the statute. I mean, but if you take a Wickard versus Kilburn approach that we can, that Congress can outlaw strictly intrastate conduct, and we don't have to worry about anything else because the legislative findings take care of it, it ignores the fact that we have this jurisdictional element that requires proof that the activities of the racketeering enterprise affected interstate commerce. And our position is that those, the effect that the jury instruction allowed, possession of the firearm and the use of the telephone, were attenuated or too tenuous under the Morrison and Jones approach.
Well, how about the carjacking case that I wrote a while ago? I mean, couldn't you cast that in exactly the same light that you're casting now? This was some guy who'd lost, a rocket scientist who'd lost his mind, running around the parking lot of a 7-Eleven store trying to carjack a car.
Well,
I found that Congress, in extending federal jurisdiction over carjacking, properly did so because of the interstate commerce aspect of carjacking. Here you have guns and drugs and all the rest of it. You can track that all the way back to congressional findings in 1968, can't you?
And I would agree, because the automobile industry is something that's very important to the national economy. And so carjacking is something that affects the national economy based on the Cortez opinion. I fully agree with that. But we're dealing with something else. We're dealing with a group of Mexican Mafia prison gang members who then go out and commit murder and assaults. And then the question is, do their activities affect interstate commerce? Not in the abstract, because we have an element of the crime that requires that the jury be convinced that the activities of the enterprise affect interstate commerce. And then we look at what activities of this particular RICO enterprise and their racketeering acts and how they affect Congress, how they affect interstate commerce. We're left with a telephone call and possession of a gun.
I thought there was some evidence that some of the marijuana had been grown out of state or moved in interstate commerce.
That's correct. There was evidence that cocaine and heroin was grown outside of the United States. So then we come to the issue, and the hardest part of our argument is the narcotics trafficking, because to a certain extent it's commercial in nature because narcotics are sold for money. But in reality, it's really street crime, and it's more like murder, assault, and extortion, and drug trafficking. It's street crime, and the evidence was it was entirely intrastate. In fact, most of it was in the Los Angeles County Jail and on the streets of Los Angeles County. And so,
if we don't look to the commodity, if we just look to the sale, the commercial transaction, but the problem is that the cases that talk about effect on interstate commerce don't cut the analysis at that point. They look at the fact that instrumentalities such as firearms used in drive-by shootings or murders traveled in interstate commerce. We look at the fact that cocaine and heroin are not native to this country and have to be brought in from international locations. And the courts have uniformly found that that satisfies the interstate commerce nexus.
Except
why should the rule be different in this case?
Except I think we come within Jones versus the United States versus Jones, the U.S. Supreme Court arson case, where they said arson of a single-family residence did not affect interstate commerce on the basis of the receipt of gas from out of the state into this state. And that's, I think, that the analogy we have is that the heroin and the cocaine were grown out of the country and they came into the United States. It's similar to the natural gas, and it's an attenuated, and it's too tenuous in order to make the...
We're back at Paul's graph right back in law school, I guess.
So I think that the more appropriate analysis is now versus Scheidler and the case of Heart of Atlanta Hotel versus the United States. And the Supreme Court has defined what an effect on interstate commerce means. And now versus Schneider says that that phrase means have a detrimental influence on interstate or foreign commerce. And the Heart of Atlanta Hotel says that that means that the effect is a harmful effect on the national economy. And this jury instruction said that the use of a telephone from one Mexican mafia calling from Oregon to California met the requirement of a harmful effect on the national economy, and that Joe Hernandez's possession of a gun that traveled in interstate commerce, that was a harmful effect on interstate commerce. Now, in Papadopoulos, they cited the Hanna case, and they said that in felon with firearm cases, you can meet the jurisdictional element of a connection to interstate commerce if the gun traveled in interstate commerce. But that's by the language of the statute. You don't have to prove an effect on interstate commerce in a felon with a firearm case, but you do in a RICO case. And it's our position that under the recent U.S. Supreme Court case of Jones versus the United States, that these are tenuous connections to interstate commerce. And my last point, I think I'm running short on my time, is that I think our analysis in this case is best found in United States versus Neron, which is the Seventh Circuit case that we cited in the opening and closing brief, which the government did not cite or distinguish in their case. In Neron, the enterprise was a group of criminals who were engaged in illegal gambling wholly within the state, and they never proved that they gambled in other states or crossed states' lines. And the court reversed in finding there was no effect on interstate commerce. And the government came in and said, now, wait a minute, there's a federal gambling statute, which and there's findings that gambling has an effect on interstate commerce, even if it's interstate. And the Neron case said, well, you can't do that because there's no similar finding in RICO, and what you have to go is a jurisdictional element requiring proof that this intrastate gambling had an effect on interstate commerce. You didn't do it in this case, and they reversed. And I think our position is the same thing with the drug trafficking. The Controlled Substance Act allows the government to be prosecute defendants without a jurisdictional element of proof in their case because they have the finding under the Controlled Substance Act. But if you follow the logic of Neron, we can't incorporate the findings on the Controlled Substance Act into a RICO prosecution because RICO has this jurisdictional element that requires proof that the intrastate drug trafficking had an effect on interstate commerce. And that's simply not what the jury found in this case. They were given a jury instruction that says you can meet the interstate commerce if someone used the telephone or if Joe Hernandez had a gun that was manufactured in another state. And that's clearly how the jury convicted the defendants in this case. Why do we know that? Because they sent a jury note during deliberation saying, what does murder and assaults and drug trafficking wholly in the state of California have to do with interstate commerce? And that's when we got the supplemental jury instructions to which everyone objected. So we know that it was prejudicial error. If they did not prove that element, if that jury instruction is erroneous, and if the Jones case and the Morrison case require the court to look at RICO prosecutions and divide them up into those that are related to businesses and harming businesses like juvenile mail, and those like the Mexican Mafia, where there's a prison gang and they involve violent assaultive crimes upon individuals, then Jones and the Morrison case step in and say, no, wait a minute, you're going to have a substantial substantial effect on interstate commerce in order to qualify under the Commerce Clause for this to be a constitutional prosecution and not a prosecution that should be take place in state court. I think that's the basic argument we're making. Many of these crimes were prosecuted originally in state court, and then they were prosecuted a second time as racketeering acts. I think I've exceeded my time. No further questions.
Thank you, Counsel. You've used it well. Who on your side is going to talk about what we'll call the Nurber issue, for the lack of a better label? Thank you. The way I understand the facts, correct me if I'm wrong, the federal government set up videotaping of hotel rooms under a couple of different circumstances, one involving the renting of the room by an informant ostensibly working for the government, other circumstances with rooms that were not rented.
by the government of the informant. Is that right?
That's correct.
Now, I'd like to hear from both sides on what authority is the federal government allowed to videotape the interior of a room rented by somebody other than the informant?
Yes, and when you get to that, if you could tell us, I think there were 14 television surveillances that came into evidence. Is that correct?
There were 14 episodes over a 13-month period.
Okay. Correct. And in 13 of those, the government rented the room?
No, I don't think that's correct. If you look at page...
Okay, let's put it the other way. How many were episodes in which one of the defendants rented the rooms? And if so, which defendant rented the room?
If you look at page 17 of the reply brief, there's a quote from a filing that we made in the district court where we addressed the issue, and it appeared based on what we could determine, there may have been as many as five instances where the defendants rented the room.
What does that mean? There may have been 25, have been 150.
Because
how many were there?
We cite various exhibits in the filing. It depends how you interpret. Some of these exhibits are tape statements. Depends how you interpret the tape statement. Whether the references on the tape referring to, in other words, references, say, for example, on two different tapes, are referring to the same instance or whether they're referring to different instances.
Yeah, but it seems to me that if a defendant is saying, my constitutional right to privacy was invaded, he's got this obligation, it would seem to me, to show that. And the way he shows it is, I was in my home is my castle, and these guys came along and they put a bug or a camera right there in my home. And so here he'd have to say, it seems to me, I rented a hotel room, and without my knowledge, there was a video camera put in my hotel room. Doesn't he have to make that showing?
That's one of the arguments. But even in the cases where the informant rented the hotel room, when you have a massive intrusion, as occurred in this case,
I hate to interrupt you, but I think Judge Thompson and I are really more interested in the situations where the informant did not rent the hotel room. And all we're trying to find out is if you know or if the record knows precisely how many times that happened, when, where, you know, all that. It sounds like it's not clear from the record, according to you.
It's not clear as the total number, but it's certainly clear that there are certainly more than one, and maybe as many as five.
You know, it seems that we would know from looking at the record. Why don't we know? Why is it maybes and could-bes? And wasn't it ever developed in the record when the government rented the room and when the defendants rented the room?
The way it came across in the district court, that was just one of the arguments. That was not a main argument that was raised in the district court.
So you attacked the whole procedure and then sort of got lost in the shuffle who rented the room. Is that what you're telling me?
It didn't get lost in the shuffle. That was one of the arguments. And we cited the exhibits that
Old Faithful has just arisen. Mr. Trevino, if you're going to talk, why don't you do it on the tape? You know, this is irregular, but it's a big, messy case, and if you can help us.
Should I stand here?
Sure.
If I may, Your Honor, I'm not sure that this is definitive, but the best that I can do in terms of answering is footnote 30 of our consolidated opening brief does recite that, in fact, it was the defense who did request the precise information the court is asking of the government. And the best answer that the defense had received was that, in most instances, Castro had rented it.
That's real arithmetic. In most instances,
I'll invite the court maybe to ask the government against. Interruption.
No, that's okay, Mr. Trevino. So you didn't have a declaration from any one of the clients saying on September 11th, I rented the room and I paid cash for it, or here's my.
That's a card slip. To the best of my recollection, those matters were outside the record and were not, for example, among the portion of the video. Those statements are not made on the videotape.
No. This is a very simple question. You're moving to suppress, and when I used to move to suppress evidence, I usually would try to file a declaration from my client which said exactly what Judge Thompson recited. I live at such and such an address. My home is my castle, and the police invaded it. I take it there was no such evidence here, a simple declaration from one of the defendants saying, I rented the room.
My recollection as a record doesn't answer that. No, Your Honor.
Your Honor.
It wasn't done that.
Okay.
The way it was done was, instead of having the declaration from the defendants, we included exhibits, tape exhibits, exhibits F, G, H, and I, and J, as part of our filing. And that's what was summarized on page 17 of the reply brief. This was the evidence that was tendered to indicate to the court.
Well, I understand what you tried to do, and I understand why you did it. I understand tactically make a decision not just to waive Fifth Amendment privilege or subject your clients to cross-examination. You tried to do it through using the statements that they made on the tape recordings themselves. But my question was really the one that I posed to Mr. Trevino, and that is, I take it there was no direct testimony in the form of a declaration by a client saying, I rented the room that day.
Correct. There was no declaration, but we didn't believe it was necessary to include a declaration when we included other evidence.
No, I understand, but now we're left in this never-never land of maybe one, not more than five, somewhere in between.
That was a dilemma we were having. That's why we asked the government and the district court how many times the defendants rent the room, and they weren't sure either.
Is it in the sealed documents?
Maybe it is. So we did the best we could, and since they didn't want to answer the question for us, we did the best we could by presenting the evidence that we had to indicate to the district court that certainly was more than one, and it appears could be as many as five. And I guess it wasn't that important to the district court in making the ruling.
I'll tell you what, we'll ask the government about it then and give you an opportunity to come back if you'd care to. We'll put the issue to the government. Where does the government get off videotaping rooms that are rented by somebody other than government?
That's exactly my point.
We understand the issue.
Okay. Then I will come up back in rebuttal. Perhaps that would be a better way of proceeding.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And we'll now hear from the other side.
May it please the Court, Ilana Artson on behalf of the United States with Assistant United States Attorneys Patrick Fitzgerald and Andrea Rusty.
Y'all going to talk?
My plan, Your Honor, is to defer to my counsel, Mr. Fitzgerald, as the sentencing issues, and I am prepared to address any of the issues regarding defendant's convictions. I may have to defer to Ms. Rusty on certain factual issues, which, frankly, I don't expect the Court to reach the individual issues, but if you have questions, we are certainly prepared to address them. Let me begin with the wiretap, and then I'll move to the video surveillance. Essentially, the defendants here contend that the wiretap was not necessary because Ernie Castro, the informant, through his central role in the organization and his attendance at these videotape meetings, was fully able to penetrate the group's activities. However, this court has repeatedly held in cases such as Comito, Grown, and most recently in McGuire, which is a case we cited in our 28J letter, that even where the informants have provided extensive information about an organization, a wiretap is still necessary or is not rendered unnecessary in order to uncover additional details about the operation or membership in the conspiracy, which those informants are not equipped to provide. And that is the key situation that controls this case.
How do we know that Castro is not in a position to provide exactly what they're looking for? I mean, their argument's a touch more sophisticated than the way you characterize it. The argument begins with the fact that there was a misleading presentation to the court, and that by hiding exactly who Castro was and then making all kinds of extravagant claims with respect to what he couldn't do, you misled the court. I mean, that's really what they're saying.
But the two claims are really tied, because the claims are that by not outlining the evidence that was obtained in the course of these videotape meetings, the wiretap was rendered unnecessary because Castro had the ability to penetrate the entire organization. What the affidavit did is two things. It provided a full and complete statement, as required by statute, of the investigative means that were used. The statute does not require that the government detail all of its evidence. What it requires is a full and complete statement of the investigative means that were used, and that was done in this case.
Well, it goes a little further than that. It also requires that the affidavit establish probable cause,
which is
and,
not disputed
and
here.
Show the district judge that it is necessary in order to continue the investigation to employ wiretapping because we can't get it by other means.
And that is correct. And the way that this wiretap affidavit made the point that I think Judge Trott is asking about is by having an extensive pre-wiretap investigation for 6 months looking at that aspect of the case that looked at those members who were in custody and how they communicated with members who were out of custody, as well as how members out of custody communicated information to those in custody to further ME-related business. And the wiretap set out that over a six-month period, there were pen registers and toll records collected of various tiers where Mexican Mafia members and their associates were housed in the L.A. County Jail, and there was an extensive analysis done of those records showing that a huge number of calls were going to Joe Hernandez's phone, and then looking at the calls that, looking at the pen register and toll record information, there were, during that period, almost 1,000 calls that were going to either a phone number or a pager controlled by Tony Rodriguez. In comparison, the wiretap pointed out that only 73 calls were going to the informant. Clearly, the wiretap showed that Castro had a very, very, very limited role in this communication process because
well,
the vast majority of those calls were Tony Rodriguez, not to Castro.
Well, Castro, what was his position in the organization?
Well, this is not a hierarchical organization like, for example...
He wasn't the president.
There was no president.
But what was he?
Well, again, the affidavit disclosed that he was a longtime member of the Mexican Mafia.
Well, no, I'm not asking what the affidavit discloses. I'm asking what was he?
Your Honor, this is not a hierarchical organization like,
you,
for example,
tell me what he wasn't. Tell me what he was.
What he was a well-respected, long-time member. And he had influence by virtue of the fact that other members respected him and that he had been a member for a long time. That does not mean that he had control over every aspect of the organization's work. In fact, in this case would show the opposite. Because the fact that he was such a high-ranking member would suggest that it was clearly not his work to be a messenger.
What?
That was the role that was assigned to Joe Hernandez, who wasn't even a member. He didn't even attend any of these videotape meetings. He wasn't a member.
High-ranking is awfully abstract. What do you mean by high-ranking?
I didn't use the word high-ranking. He was an influential member.
He was high-ranking.
I'm sorry, I misspoke. He was an influential member. He was a longtime member.
You see, when I read this affidavit, I'm just following the arguments that are made by the other side. It sounds like he's a low-level mope who doesn't know anything. And if you take a look at the entire case, it sounds like he's one of the high-ranking gurus of this thing that not only knows what's going on, but in a position to find out anything. So if you have him working for you, why in the world do you need to use wiretaps?
Because I think that is not a fair characterization, with all due respect, of the information that was provided by Confidential Informant 1. And it was laid out, for example, that there were dozens of calls, dozens of consensual recordings, that the group had meetings, that many of these meetings were recorded with the individual's consent. So the wiretap affidavit did lay out a variety of different kinds of activities and indicated that CW1 was involved in those activities. But there was another type of activity in which the affidavit laid out he was not involved.
Is there such a thing as an upper-level member of the Mexican Mafia?
There are more influential members.
Is there such a thing as an upper-level member?
Your Honor, it's very hard to answer that question.
Well, in the affidavit it says many of the upper-level members of the Mafia are incarcerated.
It's your
term, what does it mean, upper level?
It means these defendants, the people we were investigating. There was, you know, the affidavit was correct in saying that many of those high-level members were incarcerated and were not at these meetings and were not amenable to
reporting. But it seems to me that you presented CW1 as not an upper-level member. You say many of them are incarcerated, are running their activities inside and outside the institutions. Although one of the cooperating witnesses receives calls, he only receives a small number. Given the hierarchy
of the organization, there are many activities conducted to which CW1 or any of the other formats would be privy. Now, didn't you tell me a few minutes ago this was not a hierarchy?
Well, what it's suggesting is
that... Didn't you tell me a few minutes ago this was not a hierarchy?
Well...
Did you tell me a few minutes ago this was not...
I did.
All right.
I think what the
here you say it is a hierarchy. The high-level people are in jail, and MOPE number one isn't high enough to know what's going on.
When the affidavit is referring to the hierarchy of the organization, what they're suggesting is there's not one person who is a CEO and is privy to everything that all of the underlings are doing. And that was in the affidavit, and that is the fact. There was no basis to believe that despite the success, and the affidavit did specifically indicate the dozens of calls and the many meetings that Confidential Informant 1 had attended, but said, nonetheless, there are limits. And the particular...
Ms. Arson, let me make sure. The government was proceeding on a theory, if I understand it correctly, that we were dealing with the enterprise that the statute defines as a group of individuals associated in fact, although not a legal entity. Is that correct? And I think what I hear you saying is, as a result of that, we didn't have presidents, vice presidents, area managers, but de facto what we had were a group of individuals, some of whom had more authority than others. And I guess that's about as close as you can come to describing the hierarchy of this group. Is that
I think fair? That's what the evidence at trial showed. But with respect to the affidavit itself, because this review has to be based on the affidavit itself, it is true that the affidavit made clear that there were tasks that were performed by various people. Now, perhaps calling it the hierarchy of the organization was not an appropriate use
Let's take a for instance. The group decides that somebody needs to be killed, but apparently that requires a meeting of some sort and the consent of some other people before it can happen.
Correct.
And that's what happened at some of these meetings, right?
That's correct.
Okay. Give me some other examples of decisions that were made at these meetings that could not be made by one individual on their own.
Well, overall, the business of calling lights and determining which gangs were targeted was generally an issue that was decided by those out of custody as a group. There was also evidence at trial that within each prison facility, the members also had control over the activities within the prison. So within Pelican Bay, the members within Pelican Bay had the right, for example, to make decisions about whether additional members would be made. There's some taped evidence as to that, whereas the members who were not in custody were not bound by that decision and did not control that.
They were busy allocating territories.
They could still make new members outside but not inside.
Okay.
For example, whether there was going to be somebody targeted in custody in the L.A. County Jail or whether a member was going to be made in the L.A. County Jail, that was up to the members in custody. We're investigating a prison gang. And to suggest that because you have somebody out on the street who is a member of this gang and who was in custody at some point but no longer is, that it is then not necessary to have a wiretap in order to figure out how the communications are actually happening between the members in custody and the members out of custody really does not depend on how long or how influential that member was. It
what
depends
do you think,
on what,
what,
whether that member still has access to that information.
What do you think the definition of necessity is?
Your Honor, I think the best way that I can answer that question is to look at this court's case law in determining when the presence of an informant does not defeat necessity.
Does the statute give us any direction on that at all?
Well, the statute provides...
What does the statute provide?
I don't have this in front of me.
Now, people outside of Washington don't have any idea how serious Congress was on this necessity thing.
Yeah, I'm sorry I don't have the statute in front of me. But my understanding of the necessity requirement is This is understood as a way of determining that necessity means we're not using this method as a first approach or second approach. We're using this because we can't accomplish our goal without it.
Yeah, so Congress, to take your understanding, Congress said, even though there may be criminal activity going on, and even though it may be very serious criminal activity, all the stuff that's listed here, you can't use it unless it's necessary. Which means you can't accomplish the same goal in another way. Is that what it means? If you have another way of getting this goal without using this intrusive method, we're not going to allow you to use this method.
Right. Accomplish the goal as effectively. Because, for example, this court has recognized in numerous cases, again, recently McGuire, that the government not only needs to establish evidence, but proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And therefore, for example, in McGuire, the fact that the government had already obtained an indictment did not defeat the necessity for the wiretap.
And here's how serious Congress was. First of all, we have a government that works with checks and balances, which means nobody trusts anybody else in the government. So we're not going to trust the executive branch to say, it's necessary, that's the end of it. So first of all, you not only have to show it's necessary, but then you have to – Congress created another check. And at that time, it was that every application had to be personally reviewed by the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the criminal division. And the reason for that was so they could get their hands on the neck of some Assistant Attorney General in Washington, D.C., and politically assassinate that person if wiretaps were being abused. And that's how serious they were about all this stuff. You know, they saw this as tremendously intrusive. And if you, the executive branch, with a history of wiretapping Martin Luther King Jr. and all the rest of that kind of stuff, want to use this, you're going to have to show that it's necessary. And that's going to have to be first signed off on by the head of the FBI. William Webster used to examine every of these things personally. Then it has to go to an assistant attorney general. They've watered that down now, and they let it go to deputies. But then the whole damn thing has to go to a federal judge. We cross branches of government now. And that's why it seems to me that they're making this argument, that if this is the case, if Congress was serious about necessity, you can't use this unless it's necessary, that the executive branch not only has to go to a judge, but has to go to a judge openly and fully present the case on necessity. And they're saying this is too cute by a half, because you called this a hierarchy, you talked about high-level people, and now the way the whole thing plays out, Castro was in a position to get a whole hell of a lot more of information than this affidavit makes it appear. So in going to a judge, they say, this isn't honest. You should have said, Mr. Castro is a high, an upper-level member in the hierarchy of the organization who has all of these kinds of accesses and everything else. And then if you wanted to show necessity, at that point you have to say, however, even as well-placed in as many contacts as he has, he still is in a position to give us everything we need, and here's why, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And they're saying you didn't take necessity honestly here or seriously, that you tried to slide this whole thing through. Now, your answer is?
My answer is that a fair reading discloses that.
Who's fair reading, yours or the trial judge? That's why I was curious as to whether Judge Real might have thought or the district court might have thought this was a fair reading. Now, I know it's an objective standard.
Your Honor, with all due respect, I think it's any fair reading would disclose that.
All right, a fair reading is this guy's a low-level mope, doesn't know anything. That's why we have to use wiretaps. That's my fair reading. He's not in the hierarchy. He's not in the upper level. And he really doesn't know a whole lot about what's going on. And
well,
they say, if we look at the record, I look at the record, he knows a lot about
what's going on. I think that's not a fair reading of the affidavit. Look at GER 176. With CW1's assistance, the investigating agents have succeeded in consensually monitoring and recording numerous contacts with members of the Mexican Mafia. However, CW1 is not in a position to be privy to all of the activities of the targets of this investigation. That's
true, and it's misleading. He's not in a position to be privy to all, but that doesn't mean he's not in a position to be able to find out everything that's going on.
But the point is he privy to the information that the wiretap is sought for?
I mean, he was able to just go rent hotel rooms anytime he wanted to and pull in anybody he wanted to and have a big wiretapped, tape-recorded meeting. I mean, this guy was the vacuum cleaner of all time in terms of being able to get evidence.
But the affidavit established that was not the case with respect to calls going from the jail and communications from inmates in the jail. very few of those calls, 73 of those calls compared to 1,000 going to Tony Rodriguez, were going to Castro.
Well,
and that would be consistent with a person who has the access to many high-ranking people. That is not a task that is that would be performed by a person at his level. And even if it was, the hierarchy showed that Castro was not the person assigned to communicate with the messenger. Tony Rodriguez was the person assigned to communicate with the messenger.
See, the other side would say you have the same problem with your surveillance information here. You say, well, surveillance doesn't work with organizations like this. It's in and of itself, even if highly successful, rarely succeeds in gathering evidence type of activities under investigation in this case. And they would say, so what? You got Castro. He can call a meeting. Anybody comes and we tape the whole thing.
Well, those in custody obviously can't come to the meeting. And Joe Hernandez, whose phone was tapped, didn't come to any of these meetings. He wasn't a member. He wasn't invited to the meetings.
Isn't this misleading also? The telephone calls made by inmates are not monitored or recorded. Therefore, consensual recordings are not available to the government for use in this case. Isn't that only half true?
Well, it is true that the calls were not regularly recorded.
Regularly. But they're subject to being recorded almost at the drop of the hat if law enforcement wants them recorded, right?
Correct, but it was not practical to sort through thousands and thousands and thousands of calls being made from those jail tiers to figure out which ones are going to Hernandez's phones and then track them.
Could Castro call Hernandez?
Whether Castro called Hernandez or not.
Could Castro call Hernandez?
Certainly Castro could call Hernandez.
Could those be recorded?
And those could be recorded, but...
Was Castro talking to Hernandez and vice versa?
Castro was talking to Hernandez.
So why can't the FBI just say, hey, call the guy and find out what's going on?
There are two reasons. First, I think as a legal matter, this court said in McGuire that in considering how much effort, essentially, an informant has to make to try to infiltrate additional areas, you also have to look at what is the best evidence, because the government is entitled to the best evidence. And those communications from prison and from Hernandez to Rodriguez are the best evidence, and the government is entitled to that, particularly, as McGuire pointed out, the more serious the gravity of the offense, the more leeway the government is given to investigate.
So you're really interested in recording Hernandez's calls out from the prison?
He can't make calls to the prison. He can only receive calls from the prison. You can't make calls to the prison.
No, but you're interested in recording anything that Hernandez says from the prison.
We're interested in recording the MA soldiers in the jail who are calling Hernandez with information, directions, instructions, and then we want to know the instructions that Hernandez is giving them back, and we want to know who Hernandez is consulting with, because he's not a member. He's just the person playing the messenger role. Who is he consulting with? He's consulting with Rodriguez. What is Rodriguez telling him, and what are their communications? So it is true that Castro could theoretically have called Hernandez and asked him about all of these things, but how would he know what to ask him about? And Castro did not perform that role. For him to do so would have compromised his ability to act as an informant. If he tried to push himself into a role where he clearly didn't belong, he wouldn't be able to continue to play that role, and he would only get a portion of the information that was available through the wiretap, which, as McGuire noted, the valuable information is the communications themselves. And as Your Honor pointed out as well, we have to look at not only the government's right to obtain information, but the value of that information at trial. Does it constitute proof beyond a reasonable doubt? Does getting Hernandez's secondhand report of these communications, even if it is recorded, is that going to be sufficient to prove the government's case beyond a reasonable doubt? Or do we need to hear those defendants, those inmates, those associates calling Hernandez from jail? That is a factor that this court has continually held, and most recently in McGuire, is appropriate in determining whether there's necessity for a wiretap, even when an informant can provide a great deal of information, and even when in McGuire an indictment was already returned, because there's a different standard between obtaining an indictment based on probable cause and proving the offense beyond a reasonable doubt at trial. So for those reasons, the affidavits information about Castro and the tremendous amount of information that he was able to produce, he was not in a position to produce this narrow course of investigation. And it's important that this is not a case in which the government randomly chose or sort of overbroadly chose to tap the phones of those against it. It already had a great deal of evidence. We're not talking about tapping Schreyack's phone. We're not talking about tapping Gallardo's phone. We're not tapping the phones of the people who were at the meetings. The wiretap was sought for a person who was not at those meetings because there was overwhelming evidence that he was assigned to perform the role of messenger, and that there was such a messenger, and he was that person, and that was the best way, and indeed the only effective way, to get at that aspect of the investigation. I just want to spend a moment on the Franks issue as well, because I think it's relevant with respect to the necessity point that Your Honor raised as well. It is true that part of the necessity requirement is that in order for the judge to make the determination, there has to be a full and complete statement. But at the same time, the cases have recognized that if, in hindsight, that was not a full and complete statement, we still have to look at what is the effect of that. And had the information been disclosed somewhat more significant, more fulsomely, would it make any difference? And after looking at this affidavit, the district court said, no, it would not, and I submit that that was a correct reading. These facts that the defendant cite, that the information that was obtained at the videotape meetings, it did not disclose, and the defendants have not even tried to demonstrate that the evidence obtained at the videotape meetings really was centered on or developed the manner in which those in and out of custody communicated. So even had there been disclosures were videotaped rather than audiotaped, which the district court found to be immaterial, it would not have changed the necessity for the purpose sought in the affidavit. With respect to the description of Castro's position, his credibility, his information, and so on, I think this court's case in Bennett is probably the most instructive. That was a case which involved, I suppose, a now notorious DEA informant named Andrew Chambers, who was later found to have committed perjury and a variety of other offenses, which he did not disclose. Andrew Chambers was the informant utilized in the wiretap affidavit in Bennett, and the government conceded that the omission of various information about Chambers was reckless. The government didn't have that information in its files, and that failure was reckless, but nonetheless argued that it was not germane to the finding of necessity or probable cause. This court affirmed the wiretap on the ground that the district court correctly found that that material was not germane to the finding of probable cause or necessity. Here, probable cause is not even challenged. With respect to necessity, I think the point that was made in Bennett that is applicable here as well is if Castro really sort of had credibility issues, if there were concerns about Castro, that would not detract, that would add to the need for necessity, because that would add to the need to have other means of corroborating the information that he provided in order to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt at trial.
Are you saying that if the affidavit were stripped of information that was provided by Castro, purged of those statements to Castro, information he provided, that it would still be sufficient to support the warrant?
The analysis in the case of an omission is, had the omitted information been included, would necessity still be established? So if the government had disclosed that Castro had videotaped, it was up until that time, six meetings.
Well, let's suppose it had disclosed that he was a member of the board of directors or that he was some upper echelon person. You're saying that even if that had been disclosed, the need to corroborate and get additional evidence would still have existed. So the omission of that information didn't really matter.
Correct.
Okay, and it's not a question, as I first stated, that you would purge the affidavit of statements made as to him.
If there's an affirmatively, if there's an affirmatively false statement, you purge the affirmatively false statement. If there's an omission, you add back in the omission and see whether with that mix of information would necessity be defeated.
And it's the omission aspect we're looking at here.
Correct.
And it oversimplifies. They're saying you left a whole lot of stuff out. You're saying even if you put it in, it wouldn't defeat necessity.
Correct. If there are no further questions on the wiretap, I'll move to the court's questions about the video surveillance. Let me begin by addressing the record on who rented the room when. And as the defendants indicated, they submitted 5 tape excerpts. 3 of those tape excerpts relate to the August 28, 1994 meeting. And the government agrees that Triock rented the room on that occasion. There was actually a discussion at that meeting that had to do with a racketeering act regarding puppet Francisco Martinez, and one of the plans was, well, let's bring him here and kill him on the spot. And Triock said, no, the room's a name, let's not do that.
So Triock rented the room on how many occasions?
On one occasion, on August 28, 1994.
Okay.
And there are 3 exhibits that the defendants submitted. One was the videotape, which is Government Exhibit 6 itself. There was also a body wire tape 205, which I don't think either party included in their excerpts, where Castro was recounting the discussion I just told you about. And then at GER 4659, there's an excerpt from tape 157 where Castro and Triock are talking about the rental of the room for the meeting the next day. And Triock is going to go give them the money and tell Castro where it is. There was some evidence submitted by the defense relating to Morella having rented the meeting for the June 25th, 1994 meeting, which is Government Exhibit 4. That came in the form of Government Exhibit 56, which was a tape where Morella says he's going to look for a place for the meeting, and he and Castro discuss making a reservation. But it is not clear from that or from the other tape they cite where Castro, I believe, is informing Therian of the meeting and saying that Dan Barella made the reservation. It's not clear that he actually rented the room. It is not always the case that the defendant who calls to make a reservation is actually renting the room. For example, one of the audio tape meetings, there was one defendant, one individual responsible for making the arrangements, and another actually rented the room. So what the state of the evidence is that Triock rented the room on August 28th, and it is possible that Barella rented the room on June 25th, 1994. Other than that, the defendants also submitted, and this is at yard 252, evidence that on the tape of the first meeting, there's a discussion where they're collecting some money. And so Castro did get some money from the other defendants to rent the room for the second meeting on March 30th, 1994, but that room was in Castro's name.
Okay, so where does all this lead us with the record that you say as it exists?
So the question is, does the fact on those 2 occasions that Triock or Barella rented the room have any effect on the Fourth Amendment analysis? Let me back up for a moment, because the verbal portion of the tapes is covered by the wiretap statute, which contains a consent exception, and we have briefed in our papers that the informant consented, and I don't need to repeat that here. So with respect to the audio portion, that's covered by the wiretap statute regardless of who rented the room. What we're talking about here is just the issue of the visual images, and that is not covered by the wiretap statute. That's covered by the Fourth Amendment. So it is true that to some extent it is a misnomer to use the word consent to talk about consensual videotaping, because the real issue under the Fourth Amendment is not only whether the informant consented, as it is under the wiretap statute, but rather whether the defendant had an objectively reasonable expectation of privacy against videotaping under the totality of the circumstances. We would argue that under the totality of the circumstances, on those 2 occasions, neither Triock nor Barella had an objectively reasonable expectation of privacy. And of course,
Triock rented the room
against videotaping?
And there are 3 reasons for that. First of all, Fourth Amendment rights are personal. So we're only talking about the defendant who rented the room on that occasion. So on August 28, 1994, does Triock have a different expectation than he did for the other 11 meetings that he attended? And for three reasons, I would say the answer to that is no. He may have had a greater subjective expectation, but the Fourth Amendment issue is, did he have an objectively reasonable expectation? First of all, although this court has suggested that there may be some limit to consensual videotaping within a home of a suspect.
Where did we do that?
In the Nurber case, there is a footnote indicating that there may be some limit to consensual videotaping.
And what does Judge Gould say in dissent?
Well, Judge Gould's dissent was directed at a different issue, because Judge Gould was of the view that even during the time when the informants were not in the room, the government should have been able to show the videotape.
I know, but he ends with a sort of a cry in the night.
Well, his statement that, you know, rent your own room,
right,
has to be viewed as balancing the totality of the circumstances. So in the totality of the circumstances...
So I don't mean to interrupt, but are you saying it's okay for the FBI to go set up a videotape in somebody's house so long as there's a whole bunch of crooks there, and we can argue that they don't have any expectation of privacy because all they're talking about is criminal behavior, and they're misplacing their confidence in informants and everybody else? Just go videotape it. I mean, Jimmy the Weasel can give you permission to videotape a house that's owned by somebody else?
No, what I am saying is this case does not involve somebody's house. This case involves individuals going to a hotel location.
But aren't the cases pretty clear that your expectation of privacy in a rented hotel room is almost the same as your house, if not the same as a house?
But the question is, a rented hotel room for what purpose? Certainly a rented hotel room for the purpose of a business meeting is not recognized as being in the same category as your house. There was no defendant who was staying.
So anybody who's committing drug offenses out of a motel or a hotel room has no expectation of privacy against videotape surveillance?
Your Honor, it's a totality of the circumstances.
How is this different than any other crime that goes on in a hotel room? Possession of child pornography.
Your Honor, under the totality of the circumstances, there are three factors that the Nurber court looked at, and they weighed them in various ways. So on the one hand, we have the place. On the other hand, we have the presence of the informant. And then the third factor is sort of the nature of the intrusion. So, for example, with respect to a hotel room, an individual who comes to a hotel room for a meeting does not have a reasonable expectation of privacy if there's a search conducted there. You don't have standing to contest that search under Minnesota v. Carter.
Well, now you're understanding. Shyrock has a standing.
Correct. Under Nurber, the question then is, well, is the nature of this intrusion different so that a person might gain a reasonable expectation of privacy? And Nurber held, well, we think that video surveillance was sufficiently different from another kind of search in the room that with the presence of the informant, no expectation of privacy. Without the presence of the informant, there is an expectation of privacy. You have to balance the totality of the circumstances. One of those circumstances, and a very important circumstance according to Nurber, is the presence of the informant. Another is the location and the purpose of the meeting at that location. Under Minnesota v. Carter, visiting somebody's home to perform a narcotics transaction does not give you a reasonable expectation of privacy. Now, you may still have a reasonable expectation of privacy against videotaping under Nurber, and that's an issue that you don't have to decide, because we're talking business meeting in a hotel room, which is very similar to what was discussed in Minnesota v. Carter. Neither Shryock nor any other defendant was staying in this room. Nobody was living in this room. Nobody was using it as their temporary home. They were told to come to a meeting. They came to a meeting. They had their meeting. They left and went home. This was not anybody's home. And that is a very critical fact that distinguishes this scenario from some of the cases that the defense relied on in their opening brief, like Padilla and Shabazz, where you have an out-of-town defendant who's coming in and he's staying in a room and the informant comes and meets with him in that room. That person is using that as their home, and there perhaps one could say there is a reasonable expectation of privacy.
So the Fourth Amendment doesn't cover the no-tell motel, is what you're saying.
What I'm saying is there's a totality of the circumstances. So one circumstance we have is that there's a diminished expectation of privacy because nobody's using this as their home. They're using it as a business meeting just as they were in Nurber. But the second very important factor is the presence of the informant. And as Nuremberg said, the inviting former doctrine says that a defendant bears the risk that a person in whom they place confidence may disclose it. Even against, for example, in Aguilar, where this court was looking at a challenge under the invited informer doctrine against a First Amendment challenge. The court nonetheless said the invited informer doctrine holds that the government may use this means because the defendant is taking the risk that the person who they trust may turn out to be an informant. So I think that the seminal invited informer case, which is Hoffa, the Supreme Court case, made a point that is relevant in determining was there a legitimate expectation of privacy on this occasion. That was a situation where the defendant was staying in a hotel room over a number of days, and the informant, or a very experienced, had a number of communications with him. And in developing the invited informer doctrine and saying, well, there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in those communications, the court said, when speaking with the informant, the defendant was not relying on the security of his hotel room. He was relying on his misplaced trust that that person would not disclose his confidences. And the same is true here. When Triac was sitting in that room on August 28th, he was relying not on the security of the fact that he rented the room rather than Castro. He was relying on his misplaced confidence that Castro would not disclose his confidence. Because if you look at the sort of totality of the picture, was Schreier really in a different position on August 28th than he was for the 11 other meetings where he clearly had no expectation of privacy against videotaping under Nuremberg?
We'll leave your rhetorical question to end the discussion unless Judge Thompson has any more questions.
I was just thinking about someone that rents a room for a wedding reception or something like that, and then during the course these guys get over in the corner and they start talking about these things. No one's planning to stay there. You've rented the room really for a public purpose, I guess, of having all these guests come to the wedding reception. I don't know that that makes, whether that fits in with your idea that when you rent a room to hold a business meeting, with nobody's going to stay overnight there, you're not going to live there, you're not going to brush your teeth there or whatever, you're just going to hold the meeting and leave. You're not using the area as a hotel room. You're using it as a meeting place, and you could be in a commercial building, I suppose, and rent a room in a commercial building to use it for the same purpose.
And I'm not suggesting that that factor alone is sufficient. I am suggesting that the court has to look at the totality of the circumstances.
Yeah, no, let me take you to one other point. Suppose that we say, no. Shryock rented the room. This is his castle. He gave no consent, at least, to the video, and the wiretap did not extend to the video. And therefore, whatever comes in evidence as a result of that meeting cannot be used against Shryock.
The error was harmless, and here's why. Shryock was convicted of 9 racketeering acts. Of those, only two were even discussed at that meeting. That was Racketeering Act 14 and Count 14, which was Vicar Count 14, and Racketeering Act 18 and Vicar Count 17. The evidence as to each of those is detailed fairly extensively in our brief, and there is an extensive amount of evidence, leaving aside any visual image of Shryock at this meeting. I mean, there was no visual image that the government relied on. But even aside from sort of maybe whatever additional powers obtained from the visual image, there was a host of other overwhelming evidence as to each of those counts that came from outside of this meeting. So even if there was an expectation of privacy as to Shryock, as to the August 28th meeting, the admission of Government Exhibit 6 as to him was harmless.
What about Morella's?
With respect to Morella, for Government Exhibit 4, none of the individual acts as to him were even discussed at that meeting. So there was overwhelming evidence from other sources, and the admission of that videotape as to him would be harmless. I'd like to take a few minutes to be able to defer to my counsel to discuss the sentencing issues. If there are any other matters relating to the conviction.
Is anybody who's going to talk about RICO and the instructions?
Oh, I, if, if time is available, I would certainly like to do that.
It's a serious issue.
Okay. In this case, the jury was instructed in accordance with the settled law of this circuit and every other circuit that has addressed the issue that to prevail on a RICO count, the enterprise's activities must only have a de minimis effect on interstate commerce. There are two different challenges raised by us here. One is that the language of the instruction was legally incorrect because the jury should have been instructed that a substantial effect is required. And for that reason, they contend that the jury instruction and the supplemental instruction were incorrect. They also make a separate wholly evidentiary argument that even under argument that even under the de minimis standard, the evidence here was insufficient. So let me deal with those one at a time.
Why don't you go to the de minimis?
Well, are you talking about the evidentiary issue of whether there was sufficient evidence here?
Well, that's what I don't know what the other. You go ahead. I think that it was Mr. Walsh who said that at one point the jury was instructed, look, if you find either a connection to interstate commerce with regard to the drugs or telephone calls or the guns in the disjunctive, that's enough to support the link to interstate commerce.
What the jury was told is that you may consider those three types of evidence.
Yeah, and one of the three would be sufficient.
They were not told any one of the three would be sufficient.
Oh.
What the jury was instructed is, I will read the instruction. It is at GDR 2136. If you find beyond a reasonable doubt from the evidence in the case that the enterprise element of RICO has been proven and the enterprise or its activities engaged in or involved interstate or international drug trading, interstate communication devices or possession or use of weapons which travel in interstate commerce, then you may find that the interstate commerce requirement has been met. What that means is you may consider these categories of evidence. It is up to you to determine whether this has been met.
And whether the interstate commerce link existed with regard to drugs, telephones, and guns.
Correct. And in the totality, certainly, there was more than a de minimis, more than sufficient evidence to find a de minimis connection here, because all of these defendants, except for Moreno, were convicted of Racketeering Act 21, which was the drug conspiracy. And there is abundant case law that is an activity that affects interstate commerce, and there was specific evidence introduced at trial that this trafficking involved cocaine and heroin, and that those drugs are produced using plants that originate outside the state of California. So the totality of the evidence here, particularly because we have the drug trafficking element, in addition, we had evidence that Joe Hernandez, one of his additional roles was to store guns, which were bought, stored, and utilized, and available for utilization for the enterprise's activities, as well as the use of the mails, for example, in distributing drug proceeds from the jail, as well as communicating via disguised legal mail. The totality of that certainly was sufficient to show that there was a de minimis connection. The larger legal issue that the defendants raise is one that is not appropriately addressed in this case. And here's the reason why. Essentially,
being substantial versus de minimis?
Correct. And essentially what the defendants are saying is, you know, this court decided after Lopez's analysis that a de minimis connection is sufficient in a RICO case, and the defendants do not challenge that. Therefore, they contend that there is some authority that came after juvenile mail that requires this three-judge panel to reconsider juvenile mail. And the authority they rely on is Morrison. Morrison does not require this court to reconsider the prior holdings because the only hook for Morrison that these defendants try to rely on is that an enterprise that is wholly non-commercial and wholly non-economic requires a substantial connection to interstate commerce. By no stretch of the imagination can the activities of the Mexican Mafia be considered wholly non-commercial and wholly non-economic, because all of these defendants, except for Moreno, were convicted of Racketeering Act 21, which involved the drug trafficking conspiracy. So even if their incorrect theory were to be applied, it certainly would not apply to this case. If the court nonetheless reaches the merits, I would point out, and normally I do not bother with the standard of review in oral argument, but in their reply brief, the defendants assert that they preserve this issue in their Rule 29 motion, and that is not correct. It's docket number 1474, but in their Rule 29 motion at page 14, the defense stated a minimal effect on interstate commerce satisfies this jurisdictional element, and they cited this court's decision in Rome. So in the district court, the defendants consistently took the position that a de minimis connection was sufficient, but that this evidence did not establish a de minimis submission.
So your view is this objection was forfeited and subject to plain error analysis?
Correct. And with respect to the analysis on the substance, the fundamental flaw in the defendant's argument here is that Lopez and Morrison were constitutional cases. Those were cases that decided that the statute is unconstitutional as an exercise of the Commerce Clause because the regulated activity does not have a substantial connection to interstate commerce. However, the Supreme Court has never applied the substantial effects test to the question of the evidentiary burden. In other words, the Supreme Court has never said there are subclasses of enterprises, which is what the defendants are saying here. Some RICO enterprises you can instruct only require a de minimis connection, but some RICO enterprises are going to require a substantial connection. That sort of evidentiary distinction based on the type of enterprise has never been approved by the Supreme Court. In fact, the cases that the defense rely on did exactly the opposite. In the Jones case, the Supreme Court read Section 844I, the arson statute, not to cover property that was wholly an owner-occupied residence. They read the statute as not including that property specifically because they did not want to reach the constitutional issue. And I would submit that the other case that the defense relies on is Papadopoulos, a decision of this court, and that decision, which did suggest that under 844I, a substantial nexus would be required when the home was a purely owner-occupied one, that is no longer good law. After Jones, it's no longer good law because there's no constitutional analysis. That property is not covered by the statute. The constitutional analysis is wholly dicta. Rather, what Lopez said and what Morrison said, and they were both consistent on this point, is that if the conduct as a whole regulates economic activity, and this court found in Juvenile Mail that RICO does regulate economic activity, then a de minimis connection in a particular case is sufficient. That standard contemplates that there are going to be some individual cases which don't substantially affect commerce. But if the aggregate substantially affects commerce, the statute is constitutional. This type of challenge is simply inconsistent with the Lopez analysis.
And unless you have anything else on this issue?
I will defer to counsel to discuss the sentencing issues.
All right.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Patrick Fitzgerald on behalf of the United States. I will be addressing the sentencing issues. And I'd like to start by going back to a question that Judge Tallman asked towards the beginning of the now long argument that we've had today, and that had to do with the special verdict form. There was a special verdict form in this case. It is in the government's excerpt of record at 302 through 324. And it is the basis of the chart, which is the appendix at the end of our brief. And that has two important consequences for the sentencing issues. One, it really takes care of the various Apprendi arguments that survived Buckland that were raised in the defendant's brief save for Ruben Hernandez. So that's the defendant where the government has confessed error. He should be under Apprendi 60-year sentence instead of a sentence of life, and therefore his case does have to be remanded to the district judge.
He'll be happy to know he only has to serve 60 years instead of
life. Yes, Your Honor, I'm sure he will be very pleased. Now, in regard to the other arguments, which are now the main focus of the defense argument here today, which is the set of defendants whose guideline sentence is being driven by the drug quantity. That is to say, the guideline sentence that they received was determined under 2D1.1, which was incorporated into the RICO guideline. As to those defendants, the special verdict form and the verdict also has consequences for their sentence, because the district court did not start the sentencing hearings on a clean slate. All of these defendants had been convicted of Count 3 and Racketeering Act 21, which essentially meant the government had proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and the district court heard a great deal of evidence about the enterprise as a collective group, and many of these individual defendants aiding and abetting the distribution of narcotics. And therefore, in determining whether the level 38 was reached, the district court knew from the trial that there were a lot of basic facts, which of course were incorporated into the PSR and available to it at sentencing, which set the stage for its specific findings regarding drug sentencing, namely that the Mexican Mafia was this RICO enterprise, that all of these defendants, again, without getting into the nuances of the higher, were all full members and high influential members within that enterprise and had various degrees of control and knowledge of its activities. And that is important on the foreseeability issue, which was raised in the defense brief and was raised here today. And as to that, based on the information that was obtained at the trial and also at the sentencing hearings, the district court, Judge Liu, did make a specific finding about foreseeability. This is not something that is just now being raised somehow for the first time before this court. And he listened to the exact same arguments which this court has listened to, and he understood them, and that he decided, it's not that he didn't make a finding, he did make a finding, it's just he made a finding that went against the defendants. And essentially what he found, and he said this on the at the sentencing hearings and also adopted what was in the pre-sentence report, is that this was not a traditional drug conspiracy where everybody was off doing their own thing, and therefore you could say, well, should the first guy be responsible for what the other ones are doing? And is there any evidence that he or she knew what was going on? As the PSR, I think, said quite correctly and cogently, and this is quoted on pages 342 and 343 of our brief, this was a enterprise where it was sort of all for one, one for all, if I can say that about a group who are sometimes out killing each other. But the way it worked as far as the drugs were concerned, as the probation office said, and as Judge Liu explicitly found, the very heart of this particular drug extortion scheme offense was a cooperative joint undertaken effort to exert control over large drug distribution territories. And based on that finding, which was supported by the evidence of which Judge Liu explicitly adopted, he made the finding that all of these people, by becoming full members of the Mexican Mafia and going to these meetings and having an influence on its activities, they were responsible under the sentencing guidelines for the aiding and abetting of drug distribution that the enterprise did as a whole. And therefore, he did address the foreseeability issue, but he did it by finding that all of these people had knowingly and willingly, continually, voluntarily been a part of this enterprise, and one of the main aspects and profit centers of this enterprise was drug distribution, both in, quote, taxing the street gangs and then distributing drugs on its own and then distributing and controlling the drugs in prison. And once that basic finding is made, I submit to the court that it almost follows inexorably that one is going to end up at level 38, since the amount of drugs that need to be distributed to reach that level, it's really not that great once you have this overall enterprise in place. And once, as the jury found, all of these defendants are guilty of Racketeering Act 21 and Count 3. And the way the government kind of brought that home and focused it for purposes of the sentencing hearing was just to focus on one drug, namely crack cocaine. And of course, that wasn't a coincidence. That's the one that most quickly gets you up to level 38. And then brought in the evidence that was heard at the sentencing hearings that was subject to cross-examination by several of the attorneys regarding the amount of crack cocaine that various street gangs had been distributing. And based on the testimony of the three LAPD officers, which again was under oath, subject to cross-examination, which certainly was something that the district court, in its discretion, defined as reliable. Based on those findings, the district court correctly ruled that over 1.5 kilograms of crack cocaine were distributed by these street gangs. And therefore, and that was, again, there was a lot of argument in the brief and here. And in the district court, again, none of this is new. These are all arguments the district court considered at length. And while one could certainly argue whether it was exactly 138 kilograms, which is what the government proffered, or, you know, whether it was 100 kilograms or 50 or 40, I would submit to the court that it's really beyond all dispute and in no way could possibly be clearly erroneous that the amount that was distributed was over 1.5 kilograms. That's only a little over 3 pounds. So once you have this enterprise in place, and the scope of it's in place, and all of these defendants are part of it, then it really is not much of a hurdle at all to get to level 38, which only requires 1.5 kilograms of crack cocaine.
So to summarize what you've said, they got their individualized determination.
They did, Your Honor. They did when he made an individualized determination that each of them was a full member of the enterprise and participated in its affairs and had benefited from the overall structure of the enterprise. And that's something that he explicitly did as to all these defendants.
Thank you, Counsel. And does your side have anything else you'd like to bring to our attention?
Court has any further questions with respect to any issue that was raised by the defense, we'll let them take their rebuttal time.
Thank you, counsel. And we'll now turn the podium over to you. Should you care to use it?
I'd just like to start briefly with the sentencing. I really only have one comment. I'd like to refer the court to the Third Circuit decision in United States versus Menino. It's cited in the case. This was a case that involved the Gambino crime family. And essentially, the district court did pretty much what the district court did here. He held the defendants, the two Menino brothers, responsible for all the drugs, all the heroin that had been distributed by the Gambino crime family over a period of time. The Third Circuit not only held that it was erroneous. They held that counsel, appellate counsel, was ineffective for failing to raise the question on appeal because the kind of joint attribution that the court had engaged in did not comport with the guidelines.
As a matter of law, you're not allowed to do that?
I think as a matter of law, there has to be what was not done here was, I mean, it wasn't even minimally done in the sense that the judge did not even go through each defendant and say, okay, this defendant worked with these gangs, and I'm finding that these gangs sold this much. And given the nature of the evidence that came in, which, as the government has said, this was a loose organization, if any, it's simply the kind of attribution that was engaged here extended the notion of relevant conduct beyond all bounds. I only have...
We'll read the case again.
Thank you.
I only have a few points on the wiretap. The government has stressed that Hernandez, my client, was not a member, and therefore that apparently that they tapped his phone in particular. In fact, I think I have to disagree with the government's characterization of the relationship between Hernandez and Castro. Hernandez, Castro, and Rodriguez, one of the deceased co-conspirators, were close. And in fact, Castro was an extremely influential member. He could have easily, if nothing else, he certainly could have directed the calls, the jail calls, be diverted to him. If not that, I think that the relationship between the three of them was so close that the notion that Castro couldn't have easily, he was controlling Joe Hernandez. He was extorting money from him. He certainly could have, that is information that he could have gotten for the government.
What's your reaction to the government's argument that your main point is that things were left out of the affidavit that ought to have been there, but even if we add everything and clothe it in the garb that you suggest it ought to be clothed in, it still would not defeat the showing?
I have to respectfully disagree with the government in that.
I knew you would, but why?
You knew I would, because... Well, for one thing, starting with the fact that Castro had control over my client. So that was a way that certainly they could have gone a lot farther with him in regard to the jail information. In addition, with regard to the videotapes, this is something I did not point out, but the videotapes, while they consist, the six videotapes that preceded the wiretap, while they are primarily Mexican mafia members, there were instances where non-members were named as associates, targets were named. These were other leads for investigation that could have been followed up on. In addition, there were meetings at which non-members attended, not for the whole meeting, but for portions of the meeting. So that provided additional information. One of the government's arguments is that they needed to know the identities of the people in jail who were MH soldiers, who were communicating with my client, or were communicating with Rodriguez and Castro through my client. There were other sources for this information. So, no, there was... I think it's very difficult. Frankly, if one had included a reasonable judge who had read complete affidavit, that, and obviously the government doesn't have to include every fact in those thousands of pages. I would not make that argument. But if they had summarized the kind of detail that was in those meetings, I think any reasonable judge certainly could have decided not to issue the wiretap. That's the standard.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. I'll defer to my...
Mr. Walsh.
Just in brief response to what the government was saying about the jury instruction, it's our position that the supplemental jury instructions on the interstate commerce element did tell the jury that if they found any one of the three items of evidence, either international or interstate drug trafficking or possession of a gun or use of a telephone, then they may find the interstate commerce element is met. So it's basically telling them that they can reach out and find one telephone call, and they can find the defendants that the government has proved beyond a reasonable doubt that element of the crime, and the defendants are guilty based on the telephone call. And I think the jury instruction allows them to do it, and our complaint is that the statutory language of RICO is that there must be a showing that the activities of the enterprise had an effect on interstate commerce, and that's defined as detrimental influence or harmful effect on interstate commerce, and the mere possession of that gun and the mere making of that telephone call did not really fall within the language of the statute.
Even if the purpose of the telephone call was to facilitate a narcotics transaction?
Well, that wasn't... this particular telephone call was from Oregon. Mr. Castro was calling Mr. Rodriguez in Los Angeles, and it was just a private phone call that he was up in Oregon, he was coming back. It wasn't anything particular relating to the racketeering acts in the case. It was just...
Okay, how about the gun?
And then the gun doesn't... Its possession in the house didn't have an effect on interstate commerce. And it's different from the gun statute, which makes it... the jurisdictional element can't be shown by travel and interstate commerce.
So your argument would be that the gun, there would have to have been proof that the gun was actually used in one of the shootings?
There would have to be an effect on interstate commerce. There has to be a used in a shooting that thereby had some sort of effect on the commerce between the two states or foreign.
Okay, foreign. I understand your argument.
Because the felon in possession of firearms cases and statute is regulating the goods and commodities that are traveling
right.
interstate.
No, I understand.
And RICO isn't. And then finally, on the standard of review, we did file a written objection to the jury instruction that said that the element, the effect on interstate commerce can be shown by in some minimal way, then that element is established. We filed written jury instructions. We did by that filing, we were saying we don't want this jury instruction to be given.
Well, but you weren't real pointed on
and
what.
And we weren't real specific. But I think for purposes of the plain view, our language was we were asking the court don't give instruction 12 because it includes a wide variety of activities when such activities would not constitute interstate commerce. And what we're saying, what are we talking about? We're talking about a jury instruction that says that the interstate commerce element can be shown if the effect of commerce is some minimal way. So that's the only thing the instruction is saying. So we're saying don't give it because it would cover activities that would not constitute interstate commerce. And I think the instruction allowed the effect to be shown under a minimal way. We're objecting in writing. We don't want that instruction given. I think that's sufficient for purposes of letting us out of the plain view because we're not supposed to give a 50-page brief. We're not supposed to sit there and read the case, you know, verbatim into the record. It seems to me if we've alerted the court by this objection, we don't want that instruction given because it may cover activities that would not constitute interstate commerce. We should have said would not constitute an effect on interstate commerce. We left out a word. But I think that it's enough to take us out of the plain view so we can have the ordinary standard of review, which is the court has to review it under Netter if it's it has to find it harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in order to affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Do you have anything to say on the videotaping? If there are any counsel here who plan to argue tomorrow, do not be lulled into a false sense of we're going to give you as much time as you want tomorrow. This case is different.
One thing I didn't do before was to give the court my name, so I probably should do that for the tape. Jay Lichtman, I represent Mr. Shryock and the other defendants with respect to the video taping issue. Just a few points. I think it's important to recognize the nature of the intrusion in this particular case. You have 14 hotel meetings over 13 months. Some meetings lasted as long as 5 hours. The cases cited by the government, particularly what they call the invited informer cases, Gang and Corona Chavez, those were situations where there were five-minute encounters. Nothing compared to the type of intrusion in this case. And also in those two cases, the informant is the one who rented the hotel rooms. So those cases really don't apply here. Also, there was a point made by the government that this was the purpose of these meetings was to conduct business transactions. That's not exactly the case. As we point out in the brief, we had filed made some filings with respect to 106 motion, where we objected to the government's redacted transcripts. And, the exhibits that came in, the transcript exhibits, were redacted transcripts. What the defense had done was we listened to the tapes and we created our own transcripts of all, that is, the conversations that were unredacted. And we estimated, at least to the first two videotape meetings, that something like 80% of the conversations were not included in the government's redacted transcripts. And we said in our pleadings that a lot of the discussion in these conversations were about personal matters, medical problems, drug uses by defendants, talking about the status of people that they had known about, personal activities of some of the family members. That makes the type of intrusion much more serious. It's not just a brief business encounter. And that's what Nerper was talking about. Nerper referred to a brief business encounter. This case is nothing like that. If you allow this type of intrusion, what will happen is what the Padilla case, an older case, but Padilla case warned, and Padilla found the video evidence unconstitutional and suppressed it. What that court said in that case was, if you allow the government to do this, what will happen is they can go around to all hotel rooms, install bugging devices, and in this case, it's important to note that in the situations where the defendants rented the room, the FBI went into those rooms beforehand and bugged the rooms. So what Padilla was saying is, if you allow this, the government can go into hotel rooms at large, put bugging devices with the hope that perhaps there might be some criminal discussions occurring in those hotel rooms.
You have just figured out what Patriot Act number 2 or 3 is going to have in it.
Well, that's scary.
What about the government's argument that even conceding your point, nonetheless, in this case, it would be harmless error because the video manifestations really amounted to very little and the other evidence that relates to the counts in question was overwhelming?
You know, the way we address this in the district court, we argue here that it's not just the hotel rooms where the defendants rented, but it's all, even hotel rooms where the informants rented because of the nature of the intrusion. But to answer the question,
notwithstanding,
Nerber notwithstanding. Yes, I don't think Nerber goes to the contrary because Nerber does have that reference where it says we suspect an informant's presence and consent is insufficient to justify the warrantless installation of a hidden video camera in a suspect's home.
In Nerber, we said we agree with the district court that defendants had no reasonable expectation that they would be free from hidden video surveillance while the informants were in the room. That's pretty clear.
I understand, but yeah. This case before you is very, very different because of the nature of the intrusion. You don't have a brief business encounter in a hotel room. You have 14 meetings, some lasting as much as 5 hours, where personal matters are discussed. So factually, it's a lot different than what was happening in Nerber and a lot different than what occurred in the case of the government side.
But should you be so unfortunate as to discover that we disagree with you on that, what about the harmless error business on the video?
The harmless error, first of all, you'd have to it wasn't really addressed in the district court. You'd have to go back and see the extent of the taint. I don't think you can isolate just one particular video episode and say, okay, we're going to suppress this one and then determine that there can't be taint with respect to the proof of any other count. I don't think you can do that without looking to see exactly which conversations you're suppressing and make a determination whether there's evidence in those conversations that relate to a whole assortment of counts. Also, the fact that one or two or more video episodes would be suppressed might indeed have had an influence on the jury with respect to the evidence that was talked about in other conversations. I mean, it's not an isolated thing. If you start excluding evidence, then it may be that other evidence that came in would have been affected, or in the jury's mind, would have been affected if the excluded evidence was deleted. Because it's almost like a snowballing effect. When you can't isolate out a particular conversation.
That argument could be made in any case.
Maybe would have been. That's pretty conditional.
Well, harmless error is kind of conjecturing, in a sense, because you're trying to determine what would have occurred had certain evidence come out. So in that sense, somewhat speculative. And I know we've had some discussion about not being precise about specific how many conversations defendants rented, but I don't think it's a clear-cut answer. If you start excluding certain conversations, there could be an effect on other evidence.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We appreciate your help. We compliment both sides. The case has been well briefed, very well argued. These are substantial issues, and the clients on both sides have been well served. The case will be ordered to be taken under submission, and we're in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.